Honorable Chief Justice Perry will preside.
Go ahead and be seated. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
All right, our first case up this morning. Docket number 50510, Betzinger versus D.R. Horton. Counsel, are we ready?
We are, Your Honor.
Hi, Mr. Kennedy. Do you want to reserve some time?
I do. 5 minutes, please.
Before we start, Justice Seda was delayed in Las Vegas. It was unavoidable. She won't be here. She'll be listening to the webcast and participating in the conference via telephone. And Justice Cherry is recovering from hip surgery, successful hip surgery, we're happy to add. He's also listening to the webcast. He will participate as well in the conference.
Okay, very well. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Supreme Court. I'm Dennis Kennedy. I represent the appellant, Stephen Betzinger. The principal issue on the appeal is the punitive damages issue, the reduction of punitive damages from $1,500,000 to $300,000 pursuant to the statute, NRS 42.005. The Court has raised two other issues, the first dealing with the burden of proof on deceptive trade practices claims, and the second dealing with the recoverability of emotional distress damages without the showing of a physical manifestation. Those are issues on the cross appeal, and with the Court's permission, I'll respond to those in my five-minute reply. Okay. The principal issue here is one that we briefed thoroughly and very broadly in the opening brief. That's the punitive damage issue. What I'd like to do is focus on the principal argument which we believe compels the Court to reverse district court's reduction in this case. And that principal argument is this. It's the effect of the Bon Jovi versus Sullivan opinion from this court in 2006 on the statute at issue, 42.005. That statute was adopted in 1989. At that time, there was not a lot of substantive jurisprudence on the punitive damages due process issue with respect to the excessiveness of punitive damage. And what the Nevada legislature did was it adopted a statute that has some exceptions in it, but the principal operation of the statute is in amounts and ratios. Up to $100,000, you can recover up to $300,000. Over $100,000 in actuals gets you three times punitive damages. And that's the statute, and that was the statute that was applied in this case. That statute's been operative for a number of years, and the two principal cases have been decided since the statute's passage. The first, of course, is the Campbell versus State Farm case from the U.S. Supreme Court, and then this court's decision in Bon Jovi in 2006. And what this court did in Bon Jovi was pretty simple and pretty straightforward. It said what we're going to do in evaluating punitive damages awards for excessiveness, we are going to use the Supreme Court's three guidepost standard, just said for purposes of simplicity, we'll take the federal standard, and that'll be the Nevada standard. Now, in that case, that was not a case that was interpreting the statute. That was not a reduction under the statute. But, nevertheless, the issue was the same. What standards govern reduction of a punitive damage award for excessiveness? And I'll call those the due process standards. And this court said, look, there are three, and those come out of the State Farm case from the U.S. Supreme Court. Reprehensibility of the conduct of the defendant, the ratio of punitives to actual damages, and the comparison of the punitive damages to other civil and criminal penalties that could be imposed for the same conduct. Now that, in 2006, is the standard that this court adopted, and that's not the standard that was applied in the district court by Judge Lohr. Judge Lohr said, as we said in the brief, she just said, look, I've got to reduce it under the state. It's $1.5 million. I have to reduce it down to $300,000. Our position, as it was in the district court and as it is here, is the statute can no longer be the operative criterion. The ratios in the statutes and the amounts in the statutes can no longer be the operative criterion with respect to the reduction of a punitive damages award in light of this court's decision in Bon Jovi, where this court said, look, the jurisprudence and the scholarship and the teachings of courts around the country, including the U.S. Supreme Court, has come to a point now where it's not just an amount and it's not just a ratio. It is the three guidepost test that the U.S. Supreme Court established: reprehensibility, ratio, and comparison to other other sanctions that could be imposed. Now, in this case, in this case, only one of those factors was considered by the district court. That's the ratio or the amount factor, and even then, the court simply, I don't want to say blindly, but the court simply applied it, because the U.S. Supreme Court said in State Farm, look, keep in mind, there are no magic formulas. There are no magic ratios. They said, we think a single-digit multiplier up to, let's say, 9 times is probably within the due process realm. And then the court said, but there may be cases where the actual damage is small, the conduct is so reprehensible that a larger multiplier would be appropriate. In this case, and this is after the Bon Jovi opinion comes out, in this case, Judge Lohr applied the statute and didn't apply the other two guideposts. And we bring this case here to the court on a record so that the question that's presented, it's not a hypothetical question at all. It's not a hypothetical challenge to the statute being applied in light of Bon Jovi. It is a challenge made as the statute was applied in this case, because in this case, it is clear from the record, and it is clear from what the jury found, that if the three guidepost test out of Campbell versus State Farm were applied, there is a great likelihood, I don't want to say that the result would be different, but it would have a material effect on the determination. First, the factor of reprehensibility of the conduct of the defendants. That was not considered, of course, by Judge Lohr when she applied the statute. But in this case, on the record, the conduct is it borders on despicable.
Mr. Kennedy, excuse me. Before you get into that part of your argument, can't the guideposts be viewed as outer limits to the due process restraints on punitive damages? And what is to prevent the legislature from placing those outer limits by statute? If the statute is present, and those would set amounts that are lower than perhaps an outer limit analysis under the due process clause, aren't those in conflict?
They are in conflict, but of course it's the function of this court.
But does that render the statute unconstitutional?
No, it does not. And that takes me right to the final point of the argument. The statute's not unconstitutional. The legislature has the right to establish these guideposts, but it's this court's function, of course, to look at the guideposts and say, do these guideposts comport with due process? And the thing that the court has to look at here is whether or not these guideposts, which are single criterion guideposts, their numbers, their ratios, their amounts, do those comport with what this court said were the three factors that should be considered when it decided Bon Jovi and followed the U.S. Supreme Court? So the legislature has spoken. The legislature has said these are the guideposts, and these guideposts, though, are on one of the criteria. They're on the ratios or the amounts. There are two other criteria that this court established in Bon Jovi, which never got considered by the district court in this case. And so to jump to what I think the appropriate relief would be in this case is you have those guideposts. They're essentially the same guideposts that the United States Supreme Court, the one guidepost that the United States Supreme Court established, in State Farm. The Supreme Court said, we think single-digit multiples fall within the due process guidelines. And they said, maybe not always, but generally speaking, the remedy that we're seeking is to have this court say, the legislature has established one of these guideposts. It did it back in 1989 when it passed the statute. Those are the ratios and the amounts, and that's fine. But this court has held that there are two other things that have to be considered, not just the amounts and the ratios, but the reprehensibility of the conduct of the defendant and the comparison of the punitive damage award to other sanctions, civil and criminal, that could be imposed. And so the statute's not unconstitutional, and we're not suggesting that. What we're saying is that the statute now, in the hindsight of this court's jurisprudence, covers only one of the criteria that the court has established. The other two aren't in the statute, and the court can embrace the statute and say it establishes the one criterion, that being the amounts and the ratios, but we have said there are two other things that have to be considered, reprehensibility and comparative sanctions and punishment. Those, unfortunately, are not contained within the statute, so the court should, on remand, in the district court, consider both the statute and its limitations, as well as the other two criteria that this court established in Bon Jovi. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Frederick.
May it please the court, David Frederick of Lionel Sawyer and Collins on behalf of the respondents and cross appellants. I will agree with Mr. Kennedy that the constitutionality of the punitive awards have been fully briefed. I'll make a few comments on those in general, referring to the brief arguments, then I'll move directly to the cross appeal on the two issues identified in this court's order. One thing I noted from Mr. Kennedy's argument is he now asserts that the appellants are not claiming that the statute is unconstitutional. I'll address that in a moment, but I strongly suggest the court take a look at the opening brief that the appellant has filed, in which they do indeed argue that the statute is unconstitutional. Perhaps there is a waiver, perhaps not. But in any case, the key with respect to punitive damages is punishment and deterrence, not a plaintiff's right. And punishment and deterrence are public policy questions to be addressed initially by the legislature. And as a matter of fact, this court has recently reaffirmed that principle of separation of powers, that you start with the legislative pronouncements as to the parameters of punishment and deterrence. Then, within those legislative parameters, you may have, in a particular case, punishment that is unconstitutional. And that is where the three guideposts in Bon Giovanni versus Sullivan operate. Does not mean the legislature cannot establish the parameters of punishment. It does mean that the guideposts operate within the parameters enunciated by the legislature. And as a matter of fact, the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision, the Baker versus Exxon case, at some length goes through the discussion of the process by which you start out with legislative parameters and the legislature's paramount authority. Then within those parameters, the constitutional principles may indeed, as Justice Hardesty characterized, operate as the outer limits of punishment. But within those outer limits, there may be limits inside of those established by the legislature that then become subject to review for due process within a particular case. I hope this morning to be able to talk about three principal items with respect to the cross appeal. There are a great many problems with what happened in the district court in this case. They're fully briefed. I urge the court's careful attention to the briefing on those items. But three items in particular I think are worthy of discussion this morning, two of which encompass the issues identified in the court's November 17th order. The first one is the question of not merely the burden of proof, but also the scope of the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practices Act when a private party brings an action for damages. The second is the question of emotional distress damages, and particularly as illustrated by this case, emotional distress damages in financial transaction cases. And the third is the seemingly incurable problem of attorneys using plainly improper rhetoric, emotion, to induce juries to punish the adverse parties out of sympathy, passion, and prejudice. This court has confronted that problem before. The record in this case makes it crystal clear the message has not yet gotten through. Let's start out by talking about the Deceptive Trade Practice Act. Before we get to the question of the burden of proof, there is a preliminary question which has to be addressed. The Nevada Deceptive Trade Practice Act addresses the sale or lease of goods or services.
Where and when in the record below were the challenges to the Deceptive Trade Practices Act applying to these claims, A, and B, the emotional distress recovery, made?
The challenges to the Deceptive Trade Practice Act arose during the jury instruction settlement conference, in which defense trial counsel for the defense objected to the jury being instructed on the Deceptive Trade Practices Act.
On any of the claims?
On any of the claims. And it was expressly premised on the goods or services language of the statute.
So that issue was vetted in the trial court?
Yes, it was.
What about emotional distress? And I know I'm getting ahead of your...
Okay, emotional distress, I believe it also arose during the jury instruction conference, but it also arose prior to that by way of motions based upon the Barmettler case and the anticipated testimony to arrive at trial, so that there was motion practice asking that jury that emotional distress damages not be a part of the case that went to the jury.
So motion in limine?
I believe it was in the form. I'm trying to tax my recollection now as to whether it was a summary judgment motion with respect to that claim or whether it was a pretrial motion, which would in effect be a motion in limine. I do know there was motion practice before the jury proceedings with respect to that issue.
And were those raised on JMOL during and after trial?
Yes.
Mr. Frederick, at the trial, once these motions were raised, what was the evidence presented by the plaintiffs of emotional distress?
My recollection is that there was nothing other than the plaintiff's own testimony to his feelings of distress, frustration, anger, etc. I know there was no medical evidence whatsoever presented.
Was there any testimony of any physical manifestation?
Not that I recall from the record, sir.
It didn't appear to have been argued in closing either.
Your memory on that. I honestly don't recall. If it was, it was very brief. But it certainly was argued before the case went to the jury on our side. But in terms of to the jury, If there was any argument at all, it was very brief. Now, one of the things that is important to recognize about the Deceptive Trade Practice Act is that the statute itself contains no private right of action. Unlike some other statutes, which the appellant has tried to bring in on this appeal, which do address unfair lending practices and mortgage lending fraud, those statutes do have private rights of action within them. In order to get to a private right of action under the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practice Act, you have to go through NRS 41600. But 41600 only gives a cause of action to victims of consumer fraud. If you are a victim of consumer fraud, then you can sue under designated statutes that are a part of the Deceptive Trade Practice. But by limiting the class of plaintiffs to victims of consumer fraud, we bring in the clear and convincing burden of proof, and there's a very good reason for that two-step process. The Deceptive Trade Practice Act is a way of regulating the market by the state, and it has extensive provisions for doing that. Now, in that context, the question is not damage, it's not justifiable reliance, it's the conduct. Did it occur, and was it wrongful? And a preponderance of evidence standard in that context makes a reasonable amount of sense. But when you get to private injury, and you are talking about deception, whatever the source of that deception is, that's when it becomes important that the clear and convincing burden of proof standard be met. It also is telling that nowhere in the briefing on this appeal have the appellants cited a single case from any jurisdiction that allows individually negotiated residential lending transactions to qualify as a sale or lease of goods and services. That simply is not a part of the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Let's talk a little bit about emotional distress damages in transaction, financial transaction cases.
Well, before you do that, why shouldn't it? Why shouldn't disputes involving these lenders who have preyed on people be part of the Deceptive Trade Practice Act?
Because the Deceptive Trade Practice Act, unlike other Nevada statutes, doesn't deal with lending practices. It deals with the sale or lease of goods and services. And in particular, the bait and switch claim, which is the centerpiece of the appellant's claim below, that deals with the advertised sale or lease of goods and services. It simply isn't this kind of a transaction. The second reason is because we have statutes in Nevada which do deal with unfair lending practices, residential lending practices in particular. But it's not Chapter 598, it's Chapter 598D of the NRS. And there is a provision which is in the primes section of NRS, but which includes private remedies that deals with mortgage lending fraud. These matters are regulated, but they're not regulated in the same way as the sale or lease of goods and services, because it's not that kind of a transaction. Now, when we get to emotional distress,
in this context, excuse me, Mr. Frederick, in this context, the service that was addressed had to do with the purchase of a home. It seems as though where the lending transaction is coupled with the purchase of the residence, that you would take the entire transaction, you would look at the whole transaction, not just the lending piece alone, in determining whether it fits within the deceptive trade practice definition, wouldn't you?
But if, and there are several cases which have addressed, they're cited in our brief, which have addressed the notion that providing services in connection with real property interests gets you within a deceptive trade or deceptive or unfair trade practice statute. They reject that idea. And the reason why they reject it is because if that rationale were to prevail, you would then have to harmonize the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practice Act with all of the other statutes that regulate real property, and in particular, real property residential transactions, whether that be broker statutes, whether that be escrow statutes, whatever it may be. No case that I'm aware of, and certainly no case in this jurisdiction, suggests that kind of a scope for the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practices Statute. Now, very briefly on emotional distress damages. Through a series of cases, this court has established a requirement which runs in two directions. Physical impact or injury that produces emotional distress, or emotional distress that produces physical injury or illness. And the reason why that requirement is particularly important in financial transactions is because if you reach the point in which businesses must consider the risk of the ordinary emotional sensitivities of their customers, you will have reached the point at which the transaction costs then become significant because they cannot be predicted, cannot be calculated. My time has expired. Thank you.
All right. Any questions, Mr. Frederick? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me clarify.
Mr. Kennedy, before you get into your direct response to Mr. Frederick, he raised three issues that I'm concerned with. One was as to a change as to the unconstitutionality of the statute. Secondly, issues related to preserving and pretrial motions or summary judgment of the JMOL. And lastly, the issue as to no private right of action.
First off, that's what I was going to focus on. My statement about the unconstitutionality of the statute. The statute as it stands is not unconstitutional. It establishes the various ratios and guidelines that this court said have to be examined in Bon Jovi. If the statute, however, is applied without considering the other two Bon Jovi criteria, which are reprehensibility and comparable punishment, then the statute becomes unconstitutional in its application. But it's perfectly appropriate for the legislature to say these are the limits of punitive damages that we believe to be appropriate in Nevada. And this court has added to that in Bon Jovi by saying, look, if those are going to be applied, they have to be applied in conjunction with two other factors. They can't just be applied by themselves because that would violate due process. So the statute's fine insofar as it establishes the criteria, but if those criteria are applied exclusively without consideration of the other two Bon Jovi factors, then the statute becomes unconstitutional in its application. With respect to the private right of action, the private right of action is clearly established in NRS 41.600, and it incorporates deceptive trade practice as defined in 598.0915 through 0925. And in this case, what happened was those were the claims. The unfair trade practices were within those defined statutes, and the jury instructions were very clear on that. There was a jury instruction which was 7, 8, and 9. Those jury instructions specifically tracked the statute. Jury instruction number 10 set forth the elements of fraud. 11 set forth the clear and convincing evidence requirement for misrepresentation and fraud. And number 14 defined what clear and convincing evidence was. These are in volume 2, tab 54. And so the parties very carefully set these things out in the jury instructions. And the Deceptive Trade Practices Act itself contains a variety of defined wrongs. Some of them, the definition is fraudulently doing something, knowingly misrepresenting something. But some of the other deceptive trade practices deal with non-disclosures or...
What do you do with the language in 41600, though, that says the cause of action for damages is one for fraud?
It calls it consumer fraud, and then it defines consumer fraud as these particular statutes. So it's not fraud. It's quote-unquote consumer fraud. Then when you go look at the statutes, some of them use the word fraud. Some of them use the words knowing misrepresentation. But others of those don't require fraud. They're simply failures to disclose, which would not arise to fraud. And what they did, the parties who tried the case did, is they carefully constructed these jury instructions to correspond to the language in those particular statutes, some of which, and the court said, some of them require misrepresentation or fraud. This is the burden there. The others do not. So the parties were very conscious of this when they wrote the jury instructions and tried the case.
Do you agree with Mr. Frederick that the objections to the jury instructions were sufficient to preserve the arguments that he's tendering on his cross-appeal?
I do not. I would have to go back and look for them, but the only place that I looked for them was in the brief, and I don't believe I found them there. So if the court would like, I'll go back and see if you can find them anywhere, but what I looked for was, here is the way that the objection was preserved below. Now, it may have been, but it's not clear to me that that was done.
Any other questions?
Just one.
All right.
The same question with respect to the preservation of emotional distress damages. Was that the subject of pretrial motion practice?
The only thing that was in the brief was, and that's where I looked to prepare for the argument. There is one statement that was made by the defendant's counsel, and that appears in the brief, and the only thing that statement says is, where's the physical injury? And they're relying on that for the objection. And I don't think that's sufficient. If it's there somewhere else, I didn't find it. The preservation notation in the brief is simply that one statement, where's the physical injury? That's not enough.
I have one more question.
Sure, go ahead.
This is completely on a different issue. What was the proof at trial with respect to whether or not the loan that your client obtained through his father's bank could have been applied to 2715 Terrell Way or whatever the name of the street was?
I'm not certain of that proof, Your Honor.
So you don't know if that was a portable loan that could have been applied to that property or not?
I do not. I believe that's brief, but I can't recollect that.
I didn't see it in the brief. I was
okay.
Anything else?
Okay.
Thank All right, counsel. Thank you for your briefs and your arguments today. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 11:30. Thank you.